welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. A little while ago, we talked to Bob Morgan, who is the author of a new biography entitled Boone. It's a biography, a new biography of Daniel Boone. And Bob Morgan, we talked a lot about you and your growing up, many ways similar to Daniel Boone. But today, I'd like to focus on the
All of that was very interesting myself.
Well, it was for me. Well, how about Daniel Boone now? You know, Daniel Boone is such a person, almost like George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Benjamin Franklin, Johnny Appleseed, a person of both history and myth. What else was there to, why did he need a new biography?
Well, I wrote it, I think, first of all, just to please myself. I've always been interested in Daniel Boone and in the frontier period, the Revolutionary War period, which I'd written about in Brave Enemies. But I have become increasingly interested in the way the white culture, the European culture, met and mingled and fought with and learned from the Indian culture. And Boone is right at that interface. He is probably the main figure in American history in that story. And I think of him, of course, as one of the founding fathers, like Franklin and Washington, Hamilton, Jefferson. But he's also a figure of folklore, like Johnny Appleseed, and almost like Mike Fink and Paul Bunyan. So I wanted to look at his life and try to find out what is the real Daniel Boone. I mean, how much of it is myth, legend, folklore, and how much is real history, biography. And beyond that, I wanted to see if I could tell a story where I really brought him alive as a human being, not just as a legend and even a founding father, but a real person. People as famous as Daniel Boone and Robert E. Lee and Shakespeare tend to always slip back into myth. We know them best through what other people have said about them. They're legends, and I wanted to see if I could maybe nail down a real human being at the source of those legends and also tell what was legend and what was history.
To talk about peeling or taking some of that myth, the layers of myth away, what were the layers of myth that you found, and when you got them
Let me give you an example. Now, it takes a lot of bravado for somebody like myself, who's been primarily a poet and fiction writer, to get into biography, and especially a biography of somebody as famous as Daniel Boone. There's just so much material to go into. You're competing with some very great scholars and writers of the past and the recent past. There have been several good biographies of Daniel Boone. But the first thing in my search that led me to believe I could really do it had to do with the legend that in the summer of 1788, Daniel Boone and his sons in Kentucky dug 15 tons of ginseng, put it in a keelboat, and poled it up the Ohio to Pittsburgh, and then up the Monongahela to Redstone, West Virginia, put it on pack horses, and took it to Hagerstown, Maryland, to sell. Because some of that ginseng got water damaged in the Ohio, they only got half price for it. Well, I grew up in North Carolina in a family that had been digging ginseng for generations. One of my uncles not only dug ginseng, but was a trader. He was a kind of a dealer in ginseng, bought it from other diggers. And I got to thinking about that, 15 tons of ginseng. When ginseng is dried, it is as light as paper. And 15 tons or 30,000 pounds would be enough to fill a warehouse or a ship. So I went to the source of that legend, which is an interview Lyman Draper, the scholar Lyman Draper, did with Boone's youngest son, Nathan, out in Missouri in 1851. And reading the transcript of that interview, I realized that what Nathan had said to Lyman Draper was 15 T T-U-N-S, meaning barrels or kegs.
Oh.
Because almost everything on the frontier, you know, tobacco and flour and everything was carried in barrels.
It's still a lot.
Very important people. So I knew that's what it was. It wasn't 15 T-O-N-S.
Is it T-U-N-S?
T-U-N-S.
And is that a word that you were familiar with growing up? I'd never heard that word before.
Well, I was familiar with that, certainly, you know, since my college days, that back in the 18th and 19th century, a barrel was often referred to as a ton, T-U-N. And no Boone scholar that I had come across had ever caught that. They had kept passing on Lyman Draper's mistake. Well, I went to Boone's account books. We actually have his account books. They were gathered up by Draper, and I found an entry from October of 1788 where Boone said, bought 15 kegs of ginseng from Captain Fagan for Hart. That's the merchant in Hagerstown. So, of course, I was right. He had actually not dug most of that. He had bought it, and it was indeed 15 kegs or barrels.
So you exploded, if nothing else in your life, you exploded that myth of Boone.
Well, that made me feel, you know, that maybe I could do this project.
Oh, yeah.
If I could find, you know, the source of this.
So you, just to, I just shouldn't interrupt you, but this is so fascinating. You read that account.
Right.
And kind of in the back of your mind said, that can't be totally true.
Because I've actually dug ginseng,
I've
seen it. I know, you know, what it feels like, and I mean, it would take 100 people a year to dig 15 tons of it.
Well, was let's take a little diversion.
Uh-huh.
Was ginseng back in the Revolutionary War times and before? Was it a big cash crop for mountain people or for North American people? And what was it? What was the source of what? Why was it valuable?
Well, it was for people in the backcountry in the hills of North Carolina. Boone had been digging it when he lived on the Yadkin there in North Carolina since he was a teenager. He would dig ginseng and of course, trap beaver and kill deer and sell the hides. It was one of his main commercial enterprises. It was primarily intended at that time for the China trade. The Chinese would pay high prices for it. It was considered a general tonic and an aphrodisiac. It was very valuable, and there were a lot of merchants who handled it there in Salisbury and other places.
How did the Chinese originally get in touch with North American or American ginseng?
Well, there had always been a trade with China. The China trade really goes back, I guess, to the Renaissance. And European merchants and American merchants were going to Shanghai. You know the term, somebody was Shanghaied.
Right, you're right. Well, I got it. Now, I told you that I would get off topic. And I could spend my lifetime, I think, talking with you about it, but I got to stay on Daniel Boone. You mentioned Daniel Boone in the Yadkin Valley of North Carolina. I think maybe North Carolinians don't appreciate the strong connection between the Boone family and North Carolina. And I wonder if you'd describe a little. You began to talk about Daniel Boone's activities with ginseng and trapping in the Yadkin. What was Daniel Boone's connection to North Carolina?
Well, the Boone family, it was a big family. They had been Quakers in Pennsylvania, and for various reasons, they moved south. In 1750, spent a year in Virginia.
Bob Morgan, can I interrupt you?
Uh-huh.
And let's take a quick break.
Okay.
We'll come back and talk. I'll let you begin, and I'm going to let you go on for your discussion of Daniel Boone and his family in the Yadkin. Bob Morgan is the great North Carolina poet, fiction writer, and now we're talking about his first nationally published biography, Boone, a biography of Daniel Boone. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I interrupted Bob Morgan, the author of a new biography of Daniel Boone coming out this year. And I asked you, Bob Morgan, to talk about the Boone family connection and Daniel Boone's connection to North Carolina, particularly up in the Yadkin Valley where they lived. And I interrupted you, but would you start all over? And
Certainly. The Boone family, large family, moved from Pennsylvania, near Reading, Pennsylvania, to Virginia in 1750, and then on to the Yadkin Valley close to Salisbury in 1751. The legend is the family lived in a cave on the Yadkin. In fact, you can visit the cave south of Winston-Salem, where supposedly they lived at first, and then they built a cabin near Dutchman's Creek. They bought land from Lord Granville. You could buy land very cheaply there in the Yadkin. It was pretty wild country. And then pay a quit rent, a small rent, a few pennies an acre every year. This is back in colonial North Carolina. But Boone just, Daniel Boone just took to that region. It was still kind of wild, and there were lots of deer and beaver and the Indians around, Catawba Indians. You go a little further west, and there were Cherokee Indians. It was really while he was growing up there as a teenager that he became a famous hunter and commercial hunter and trapper, and really learned the ways of the Indians, learned from the Cherokees and Catawbas, and knew them. Was famous among them as a great hunter. The story is that in that region, in the mid 18th century, a really good hunter was called a Boone, named after him. He was already that well known. Won all the shooting matches. He met and married the beautiful Rebecca Bryan, who lived just north of the Boones in the Yadkin Valley. And they moved to a community called Sugar Tree, which meant there were sugar maples there. People on the frontier got their sweetening at that time from maple syrup and maple sugar. There weren't many bees in western North Carolina at that time. Sorghum had not been introduced. So Boone really grew up and became the man, the hunter that he's known as in North Carolina. He lived in North Carolina for about 20 years, began to explore farther and farther west into the Blue Ridge Mountains, and in 1755 he was with the North Carolina militia at Braddock's Defeat up in Pennsylvania. And he's working as a teamster. He met another young man in the militia there serving with Braddock named John Finlay, who had gone down the Ohio River and traded with the Indians at the Falls of the Ohio. That's where Louisville is now. And by the campfires, he would talk about this incredibly beautiful country, this paradise called Kentucky by the Iroquois. It was a place of clover and cane and buffaloes and unlimited deer and elk and beavers, the most beautiful place in North America. After that, Boone made up his mind that eventually he was going to get to Kentucky and hunt there. It took him a long time. It took him, I guess, about 14 years to actually get there.
Well, now, So this was 1755, fighting, I guess, in the French and Indian War?
Right.
And then he came on back to North Carolina, though.
He came back to North Carolina and married Rebecca Bryan and started a family. But every year he went further and further west. He was always working his way west. He and his friend Nathaniel Gist, future father of Sequoia, the great Cherokee who invented the alphabet, the Cherokee alphabet, around 1760 met a slave named Burrell, who was a herder in the mountains and who showed them the trails to the western waters, that is, to the Kentucky, to the Watauga River and to the New River, showed them a herder's cabin exactly where Boone, North Carolina is. And Boone used that cabin sort of as his headquarters for a lot of hunts. Stones from the chimney of that cabin are in the monument to Boone under the statue there in Boone, North Carolina. But it was from there that he kept launching out further and further down the Watauga into the Holston Valley, into the Clinch River Valley, working his way west successive years on his hunts, working his way toward the real west, which was Kentucky.
He was hunting? Was he settling or just going to hunt and bring back?
His family still live there on the Yadkin. They've been moved north on the Yadkin, later to near North Wilkesboro. His last cabin, three cabins, were there on the Yadkin near North Wilkesboro. But he was exploring into what became Tennessee and into eastern Kentucky all those years, going on longer and longer hunts. He could not actually get to Kentucky. I think he couldn't, because he was always in debt, afford to outfit a big expedition to go all the way into Kentucky until John Finley, this peddler whom he had met in the French and Indian War, showed up there on the Yadkin in 1768 and suggested that together they could pool their resources and perhaps get some support from Richard Henderson, Judge Richard Henderson, who may have been subsidizing Boone's expeditions already for information about the land over the mountains. Because everybody wanted Kentucky. Washington wanted Kentucky. Patrick Henry wanted it. Jefferson wanted it. The king wanted it. The governors of North Carolina and Virginia and Pennsylvania wanted it.
Well, who owned it?
The Indian War wanted it.
Who owned it?
Well, some of the Indians claimed to own it. The Iroquois had controlled it for almost a century as their buffalo hunting country. Now, they lived in upstate New York, but they were so big and powerful that they could, in effect, order the other Indians not to build villages there. It was called the Dark and Bloody Ground by some people because the Indian wars for control of the fur in Kentucky have been so violent and so bloody.
In Daniel Boone's exploring, both in the Yadkin and then across, then up to where Boone is now, across the mountains into Tennessee, and then ultimately into Kentucky. What was his motivation for these hunts? Was it economically profitable? And if so, how did it work?
It was very profitable. He could go into the wilderness, spend the summer hunting deer. You hunted deer in the summer when their hides were in prime condition, and come back at the end of summer with a horse or two loaded with deer hides, worth more money probably than he could have made in a year or two of farming. A deer hide was worth a Spanish dollar, so a dollar came to be called a buck.
Well,
In the wintertime, he could go into the same wilderness and catch hundreds of beaver, and they were worth even more than the deer hides. However, because he was hunting and trapping in Indian country, the Cherokees would sometimes catch him and rob him and take his fine Pennsylvania rifle and his furs, and he would cheerfully hand them over.
Why wouldn't he put up a fight or
he'd be killed had he put up a fight, but also he was going into the wilderness for other reasons than commercial. I mean, he did need the money and he wanted the money, but he was exploring. He was curious, and he just loved to go there anyway, so he could cheerfully hand over this fortune in furs and survive to go back and hunt again, because he knew these things did not belong to any one person. He had absorbed enough Indian sense of things to know that they belonged to everybody, and he would have gone there if he didn't make anything, and he would buy a new rifle, make a new rifle. He was a gunsmith. And go back again.
All this time,
the Cherokees admired him a great deal. They, I believe, would keep him under surveillance until he had accumulated all his furs. He was such a good trapper, and then they would hit him up, and he would talk to them. They would smoke a pipe and have a drink from his flask. They called him Big Mouth or Wide Mouth because he loved to tell stories and laugh. He had such a good sense of humor. But among the Cherokees, he was always known as Badmouth.
So even when he was being, the way we would look at it, being robbed and fortune taken away from him, he would sit down and socialize with his, with the robbers.
Oh, absolutely. He called them brothers, and they called him brother. And some of the robbing was done under the guise of a trade. Now, this is very common among Indians, that you wouldn't say to somebody like Boone, I'm going to steal all your furs. I'm going to take them. They would hold out their cheap musket to trade him for his fine rifle. They would hand him some wampum or something that they had in trade for all of his furs. So it was all done with great cordiality and politeness as a trade, but everybody knew it. They were stealing his valuable furs. Boone understood their culture. He understood their language, and while so many other hunters and trappers were killed, he survived.
Well, we're talking to Bob Morgan, Robert Morgan, the author of Gap Creek, of award-winning poetry, and now the author of a new biography about Daniel Boone. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Robert Morgan, author of a new biography of Daniel Boone. And Bob Morgan, I'm doing a better job than usual of letting you tell that story, but still not good enough. You've got us, Daniel Boone's family and his family are living in the Yadkin region of North Carolina, but he is exploring and hunting all over across the mountains, finding new ventures. First question is, did his family and his children are being born in North Carolina? He's really a North Carolinian, even though he's, at this point, even though he's venturing across the mountains. Am I just wishing that, or is that fair?
That's true. One of the paradoxes about Boone's character, which I discovered in this project and I try to make clear in the book, is that while he was this hunter who loved to go off in the wilderness for long periods, often solitary, nobody at all with him, maybe a horse, maybe a dog. He was also a family man, and he was very popular among a large circle of friends and relatives. When he was back in the settlement, he was very much admired. He was a natural leader, and his family admired him a great deal. Almost everybody who left a memoir of Daniel Boone spoke of him with great affection. So there are these two sides to his personality, that he loves to go out in the wilderness for weeks, sometimes months, sometimes even years, in these solitary voyages of exploration and hunting, ever westward, going further and further westward. But then he would come back, and he'd be very sociable. He was a great storyteller. He could persuade people to move with him whenever he wanted. Wherever he moved, there was a large entourage of relatives and friends. He went with them up the Yadkin and across the mountains into Kentucky and eventually even all the way to Missouri.
I hate to leave North Carolina and even hate to leave the mountain regions of North Carolina and Tennessee, but tell us the story of how Daniel Boone made his way to Kentucky.
Well, he had hunted in the mountains of eastern Kentucky before, but he wanted to get to the bluegrass. Everybody wanted to get to the bluegrass. That is the Kentucky River Valley around where Lexington is and Georgetown. When John Finlay showed up in 1768, he and Boone began to plan a large expedition into the bluegrass. And they figured if they could find this great Indian trail, the Warrior's Pass, which follows the great wagon road down to Roanoke, and then it goes through Abingdon, Virginia, which was called Wolf Hills at that time, then over to the Long Island of the Holston, which is where Kingsport, Tennessee is now. If they could find that trail, it would take them to Kentucky, because they knew that Indians had been going there for thousands of years. And that's exactly what they did. There were six of them, a man named John Stewart, John Finlay, Daniel Boone, and three camp helpers, sort of assistants. Each of them had two pack horses, and they crossed the mountains there at Boone, went north, and found the Warrior's Path at Abingdon, went west on it. They left May 1st, 1769. It was a very important date in American history. And they did indeed follow the trail down to Powell's River, and eventually they came to the gap called Wasiota by the Indians, Cave Gap by some hunters, but it had been named in 1750 by Dr. Thomas Walker, Cumberland Gap.
Well, now, excuse me, 1750 it was named Cumberland Gap, but Boone gets the credit for discovering it.
No, he did not discover it. That's part of the legend.
Okay, well, fill us in on that.
Thomas Jefferson's guardian, Dr. Thomas Walker, was hired by the Loyal Land Company in Virginia to go and explore the mountains and hopefully to reach the great meadow of Kentucky, of Kankakee. He and his party did find Cumberland Gap and name it, and they found the Cumberland River, but they never went north. They went back east in the mountains and found the headwaters of the Big Sandy River in the mountains of eastern Kentucky, and then went back to Virginia. It was just so wild, they couldn't find their way all the way north into the bluegrass.
So Boone found, what Boone did was to find it and announce it as a gateway to the bluegrass.
He made it famous, but white hunters for generations had probably been going through it and not telling anybody where it was.
I see. Uh-huh.
To keep this great buffalo hunting country a secret. That's part of the paradox of Boone. I mean, he's the great hunter. He loves the wilderness. He loves the pristine wilderness. And yet he's the one who leads all the people in to destroy it. That's a part of the paradox of Boone's life and of American culture, actually.
Well, I guess, Boone then came back to North Carolina, I guess, after this expedition. And lived for a little bit, or did he?
Well, let me tell you about this expedition. It's very important. He and Stewart and Findlay and their associates certainly found the bluegrass. And they had this idol in the wilderness for 6 or 7 months, just catching all the furs they wanted and killing buffalo and deer and exploring. Boone went out exploring. He explored all the way to the Ohio, called by the French La Belle Rivière. He explored as far as the falls, where Louisville would be. He found the Blue Licks, these salt licks, where there were so many animals. And in December of 1769, he and Stewart were out hunting and were captured by some Shawnee Indians. They had not seen an Indian before that. The place was almost empty of Indians. To make a long story short, he did escape from the Indians, but he lost all their furs and all their horses, all their rifles and gunpowder. And the other men went back to North Carolina, but Boone and John Stewart refused to go. They were going to stay there and keep trapping and hunting. And just at that time, Boone's younger brother, Squire Boone, showed up with another man and with pack horses loaded with supplies, almost certainly sent by Richard Henderson of Salisbury to supply Boone. So Boone decided to stay for another year, hunting and trapping and exploring. His friend Stewart was killed by Indians or disappeared, but he still stayed. At the end of the year, and that is in May of 1770, Squire took their furs and deer hides on pack horses and went back to North Carolina, and Boone did not go back. He was expecting to have gone back. He wanted to stay in Kentucky and explore it further. I think that's the most important period of his life. This is the very center of the legend of Boone, the reputation, the solitary explorer. As far as he knows, there's not another white man in the wilderness of Kentucky. He has it all to himself. And even though he's low on powder and lead, he is so thrilled by being deep in this pristine wilderness that he does not leave it, does not return to his family, but stays for another year. And By the end of that year, he probably knew Kentucky better than anybody else, certainly any white man. But I think that is probably the most important 2 years of his life, when he stays often alone in the wilderness, exploring, hunting, relishing it, very much like an Indian, I think.
Wow. We're talking to Robert Morgan, author of a new biography of Daniel Boone. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is Robert Morgan, author of Boone, a biography. And we're talking about Daniel Boone. We've, gosh, Bob Morgan, I've slowed you down, and we've just got a few minutes to finish up. This time in the early 1770s, Daniel Boone's alone in Kentucky. You say this was his happiest, maybe most important time. Was the rest of Boone's life downhill from there? What happened after that?
Well, he returned to the Yadkin, to his family, in the spring of 1771, just as the Regulator movement is being squashed at the Battle of Alamance. And on his way back to the settlements, he and Squire were yet once more robbed of all their furs and their horses and their guns. So he returns to the Yadkin broke, with nothing to show for this 2 years in the wilderness, really, except his knowledge of Kentucky and his delight in that wilderness. He makes up his mind that he is going to take his family to Kentucky, and accompanied by a number of friends and relatives, they're going to form a settlement in Kentucky. But it's so far away, it's so dangerous to get there, and it's so expensive to outfit an expedition, he's not sure how he's going to do it. So the next 3 years are spent putting together a group of people who will go to Kentucky. They finally get to Powell's Valley, almost to Cumberland Gap, in the fall of 1773. He's working with somebody named Captain William Russell, who lives there on the Clinch River, a Virginia planter related to Patrick Henry. But Indians attack and kill his son and kill Russell's son and several other people in that expedition, so they decide it's just too dangerous. They turn back, and Boone and his family live on the Clinch River for almost 2 years, waiting to prepare another expedition to move into Kentucky. Of course, in 1774, what is called Lord Dunmore's War intervenes. That is a fight between the colonies and the Indians of the Ohio Valley. Boone is commissioned a lieutenant and then a captain in the Virginia militia, and for the first time becomes a military man. The son of Quakers becomes a military man. He acquits himself very well, and at the end of that, he's thought of as an officer and a gentleman, much more than before, not just a hunter.
Well, how does that lead to settlement of Kentucky? Is it?
Okay, this Judge Richard Henderson I mentioned earlier has finished his term as a judge for the colony of North Carolina. He held court in Hillsborough. He's been attacked by regulators in the meantime, but he survives. And he and a group of men in Salisbury, the Hart brothers and his law partner, John Williams, subsidized an expedition for Boone to go into the Cherokee villages and negotiate with the Cherokee Indians to sell a great chunk of Kentucky, all of Kentucky between the Kentucky River and the Cumberland River, about 20 million acres. Now, this is strictly against the law of North Carolina and Virginia and the Crown, but Henderson is a brilliant lawyer, and as a sliver of legal justification, he thinks, in a treaty signed between the Crown, Great Britain, and the Cherokee Indians at Hard Labor, South Carolina, in 1768. It says the Cherokees do have a right to some of Kentucky. And he has Daniel Boone, who knows the Cherokees, is highly respected of the Cherokees, go among the chiefs, like the great chief Atakulakula, and negotiate the sale of Kentucky for the future colony of Transylvania. That's how Boone ends up hacking out the Wilderness Road through Cumberland Gap. It's called Boone's Trace, actually, at that time, into Kentucky. And he builds Boonesboro in April of 1775 for Judge Richard Henderson in this new colony of Transylvania.
Wow.
And then brings his family later that summer to live in Fort Boonesboro there on the Kentucky River.
Well, I'm going to interrupt this sort of our discussion of this life because we're coming to the end of our time. And as you reflect about Boone's life, what is it that captures you for Boone as you look back about his, as you look back and try to measure his influence both on history and literature and the whole American way of looking at itself, at his country?
In some ways, Boone is the most important figure of his time for American culture, certainly for romantic literary culture later. The legend of Boone is created by a man named John Filson, who publishes The Adventures of Colonel Daniel Boone in 1784 as an autobiography. It purports to be an autobiography, and this is really a classic work. It was read in North America, is read in Britain, read in the continent, and it created the legend of Daniel Boone as the natural man, the white Indian, the person of the wilderness. This deeply influenced American thinking about the West, about itself, about its destiny in the West. It influenced the romantic poets of Britain, and it created the paradigms of the romantic figure that really led to Cooper's writing about the wilderness, and then Emerson and Thoreau and Whitman, even. By the early 19th century, Daniel Boone was so famous that he had created a type of hero that didn't even have his name. I mean, it was just a type of American hero. So that when Emerson is writing self-reliance or writing nature, he's writing about a spirit, an attitude, which was partly derived from this legend of Daniel Boone, the man of the wilderness. When Thoreau writes about solitude or life in the woods, or in his great essay called Walking, about going to the West, going to the wilderness, going to the wild, he's drawing on this figure that had originally been derived from Boone's life and Boone's legend. So he's the very source of America's romantic idea of what it is, what its destiny is, its character. There's nobody quite like him. The mountain men, Davy Crockett, Kit Carson, and people like that are like echoes or reflections of this original legend.
Now, Daniel Boone was not a highly educated person, but I sense that as a poet you feel some brotherly effect, that you've almost brought him into the brotherhood of poets
He lived poetry. He was a poet, but his poem was his life. His experience of the wilderness and of the American landscape and of the Indians, his interaction with the Indians. And while he had little formal education and was not a good speller, he actually read a lot of books and could be really eloquent verbally. One of the marks of a leader among Indians was the ability to talk the big talk. That is, to be a chief, you had to get up in front of people and move them, persuade them. And Boone proved a number of times he could do that with both white audiences and Indian audiences. He could talk the big talk. He was a very eloquent man. His son said he took history books with him. He read them in the wilderness. He read them by campfires. He loved history. And later on in life, he read the Bible every day. He loved the Bible. He, of course, had been taught the Bible from his childhood. He loved Gulliver's Travels. They read Gulliver's Travels in 1770 by the campfires on the Red River in Kentucky and named a creek, Lullabygrud Creek, after a place in in Gulliver's Travels.
So you think he might, in today's world, be reading Harry Potter, too?
I wouldn't be surprised if he wasn't an actor. He might be the George Clooney of our time. He had an enormous effect on people. He always knew how people would see him, and he could tell great stories, and he really knew how to make an impression. He was like Washington that way. If Boone was in a group, everybody knew who was in charge, who the leader was.
Well,
charisma.
Maybe this is a good place to stop. It's certainly, this is a conversation I wish I could continue for a long time, Robert Morgan, but your affection and admiration for the subject of your biography, Daniel Boone, is evident, and we appreciate your sharing it with us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to all y'all for listening. We'll be back same time tomorrow.